Being a mother is the coolest job in the world and the most meaningful.
Hi, and welcome back to Reclamation Radio. I am Dr. Kelly Brogan, and today's guest is Erica Commissar, who is a psychoanalyst in New York City, who wrote the book, Being There, Why Prioritizing Motherhood in the First 3 Years Matters. I certainly wish I had read this book 15 years ago, and it is never too late to experience the exhale that ultimately comes with resolving the many, many a gaslight we are delivered as women, and specifically as career women, and specifically as career women who are also mothers. So we cover why feeling bored by your infant is a sign of intergenerational trauma and loss, why there is no such thing as so-called work-family balance for women, and the root cause of our attachment issues, aka our myriad dysfunctional relationship experiences in society at large, and why we as women have an extraordinarily powerful opportunity to change the course of human history. Once we have access to information like this that allows us to reconnect to our instincts and our intuition. Enjoy. Welcome, Erica, to the show. I'm so excited, as I was mentioning offline. Excited and also have some degree of trepidation around the delivery of this essential message. When I finished your book, I thought, I'm going to get her on Reclamation Radio, and this is going to be one of the most important conversations that I have because of the potential that your work has to change the course of not only a woman's life, but a family and potentially even an intergenerational legacy. And it certainly falls into the category, as I mentioned to you, of, you know, information that allows you to know better and do better, right? So there's just some things that we get exposed to at just the perfect timing, and it expands what I refer to as the permission field to exist and behave as a woman in ways that we didn't imagine we had permission to previously. So I know this can be challenging to listen to, and I'm super sensitive to this, empathically so, to any mamas who have older kids, specifically career women. And I also know that this will land in many, many receptive, you know, hands. And I am, yeah, really delighted that you're here. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to dive into the deep end with you, and then we will unpack it a bit. I want to know, what is your current perspective on whether women can have it all? Because I know that I absolutely was a poster child for a feminist who believed that I could do what men could do bleeding. And not only can I do that, but I can also juggle, you know, 10,000 different tasks and roles and hats, and I can do it more efficiently and more effectively. And I can also make sure to check all of the boxes of the needs of everyone around me and make sure that I go to sleep feeling like a good, productive girl. And I lived this life for many, many, many years until I started to recognize what I now call the dupe, you know, and the dupe that is the promise of a lot of feminist programming and the promise of you can be a career woman and also a wife and a mother, and it's no problem. You're going to experience all of the freedom and the independence and the entitlements that you were, you know, that you were told were coming your way. Now you have them. Enjoy your life. And of course, I am surrounded by and experienced my own version of the unfulfillment, the kind of glass wall, functional freeze living that is being on autopilot and not actually dropping in, you know, through the intimate connections that are in my midst, right? Like just sort of being in this doing mode. And I also have experienced kind of bereft nature of achievement and success and, you know, productivity as a woman. And I look back on those early years with my kids when I prioritized my career. I was back to work at, believe it or not, and I know you will, 6 weeks back in my medical fellowship, and then 3 weeks in my second, three. Because I was in private practice, I thought, oh, I'll just scoot out to the office. So I no longer believe
that you can have it all. I no longer believe that that promise is anything but a glittery object we will chase forevermore and never actually grasp. So I wonder, you know, how you might enter the conversation on women being able to balance, it's my favorite term for it, euphemistically, work and family. And how possible is that really?
Well, I mean, first, thank you for teeing all of this up by using the word sensitive. So I'm going to be as sensitive as I can be while still being direct, because I'm a pretty direct person, but I'm also a therapist and a psychoanalyst. So I also can be very sensitive. So I'm going to talk about it as sensitively as I can. The feminist movement was not a communal movement. It was an individualistic movement. It was not a movement about children. It was a movement about women as individuals, because women had been deprived of consideration as individuals. They were only seen as wives and mothers, and they weren't then seen as individuals. Let's say that. So there was a very important component which allowed women to individuate and say, well, I am a wife and a mother, but I'm more than that. I'm also a doctor or a lawyer or a therapist or a teacher, right? But the problem is that it did tell women, you can do everything. You know, we call it the me movement. Me, 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 me. You can do everything. And so technically, if what you mean by doing everything is you can work full time, be powerful, be famous, be high powered and make a lot of money and still raise children, the answer is yes, you can do that. The consequences of it, however, were not talked about, which is that there are going to be consequences. And so now we're seeing the consequences, because you can do it all, but you cannot do it all at the same time and do it well. Something has to give. And for the feminist movement, what had to give was children had to give, family had to give. The problem is that children are not like vases or cars or, you know, an object that you can treat like an inanimate object. They are human beings with irreducible developmental needs. And we didn't take that into consideration when we talked about the individuality of women. The answer is you can do it all, just not all at the same time. You can be a career woman. You can be powerful and rich and famous if you want to be, and all of those things, but you can't do that at the same time that you're raising young children. If you want those young children to grow up to be healthy children and adults. And that's what we didn't tell women. Because if the feminist movement had said, there are going to be consequences and your children will suffer, but you're taking one for the team, many women would have gone out and done it anyway. And many would have said, you know what? Let me wait till my kids are a little older. And that way I can still be independent and be individual and have more of aspects of my identity, but I don't have to do it exactly at the same time that I'm raising little ones. So there was a whole omission there. So you want to say they omitted a big piece of this puzzle. And now we're seeing the results of that, which is for three or almost four generations, women believe that they can, you know, be out in the world all the time and that quality time with children is just going to be enough. And, you know, my book was meant to say it's not, that you can't just have to be there. You have to be there physically and you have to be there emotionally, because infants are born completely neurologically, emotionally, and physically fragile. And so what they require for their irreducible needs is they require something called attachment security, which is informed in the first few days or weeks or months. It takes years. It takes 3 years for a child to feel safe. So, and what you do by being as present as possible is that you reinforce the initial bonding, which, you know, initially a child can bond with their mother in the hospital or at home or for the first week or a few weeks. Sometimes bonding even takes a little time. So I have mothers that write me and say, you know, my child, I'm not bonding. I said, well, it's not too late. I'm going to teach you how to do it. But the idea is that the bonding process is not the attachment process, the attachment security process, the process by which a child feels safe in the world, feels secure that their environment, which is you, will meet their needs, will provide for them, will protect them, will create a feeling of enduring security and safety for the future. That is the foundation of that child's personality and their future mental health. And that's what we've omitted from telling women. We've really lied to women. We've gaslighted women in order to get more of them into the workforce faster. So what I said is you can have everything in life and do it well, just not all at the same time. You can have a brilliant career before you have children. And then you can even take a little time off and ratchet, you could go back to work, but ratchet it down so much that your children are the priority and the time with them and your mind on them is the priority rather than your work. So what that means as women is we have to give up our vanity. We have to give up our fear for trust. So we exchange trust for the fear that we have that we'll become insignificant and lose value because we're not working out in the world. The most valuable and significant work you will ever do is creating the foundation of your children's mental health because you can't get that back.
I recorded a solo cast, I don't know, maybe it was 6 months ago or so, called Choosing Motherhood. And in that, I describe this, you know, epiphanal moment in my life. My daughters are teenagers now, where I recognize that as much as I absolutely adore my daughters and always have, as much as I have been deeply invested in their physical well-being, and I have had the honor and privilege of having my family, my parents, very involved in their care, so I've not ever paid for care, I recognize that I have never put my role as mother first. Right? Because it's felt like I've put my kids first a lot of the time. Okay. But it's my role as mother that I never, ever in their whole lives had put first. And I am very interested in root causes, right? So when I track back to the root of that anguish that started to surface within me, I found that my careerism, and you could even go so far as to say workaholism, and all of, in my case, the woundology that was driving that, right? My need to feel seen and validated and powerful and important and all of these, what I would refer to as masculine drives that fueled my career from its inception, that I allowed those to dominate the field of drives in my lifescape. I sometimes wonder, you know, if I had a woman whispering in my ear, you know, back when I first decided because I made the choice to have my eldest daughter. If I had a woman whispering, or maybe you whispering in my ear, would I have been able to hear it? Right? Like, would I have been able to hold these fears that you're talking about that I wouldn't be able, I would like, it's like a FOMO, right? It's like, I wouldn't be able to like get back in the game, or I'd miss out on something essential, or this like churning, you know, hamster wheel would somehow take off without me and I would fade into irrelevance. But the real sort of factor, I think, that supported my rushing back to work was something that you talk about in your work, which is this normalized sense that it's okay to just need adult contact, to get back into your cerebral arena of expertise. And, you know, I was so inspired and stimulated by my work and my patients at the time that I would have been bored, right? That's the narrative anyway. I might have been bored if I stayed home, or I might have like, oh, I just don't really like playing with kids. I'm not like that kind of a mom. So I'll make sure, you know, that they have pumped breast milk, and I'll make sure that they have, you know, the best loving hands taking care of them. And I'll just scoot off back to work because that's where I feel most at home, right? So this I now know is coupled with, whether it's conscious or not, a sense of guilt, right? So you talk about how when we normalize that guilt and we normalize what it is to just need adult contact and stimulus and like get back into the swing of things with work, we are unable to perceive and appreciate these consequences you're describing as relevant, right? Like, especially comparatively relevant, because it just feels like, oh, this is just how it is, right? It's, you feel a little guilty and, you know, you already have a career, so you're going to head back to it and it feels good. And you're just going to do the best you can to make sure your baby is like well cared for. But what you're talking about in terms of these consequences, I just want to put neon lights around, because any woman who has been in a relationship, okay, like romantically, knows that we are in an attachment crisis that is multiple generations deep, okay? The relational dysfunction that fuels the therapeutic industry is not just part and parcel of the human experience, right? I would argue that what you're exposing is the ultimate root cause of our attachment issues, of our dysfunctional relationships, of even divorce epidemics, of this idea that we don't know how to feel seen and understood, to feel autonomous and connected in relationship. Okay, like, where does that start? Is that just a part of being a human? No, it starts with absent mothers, right? And absent mothers starts with prioritizing career over family, or imagining that these are like, it's interchangeable hands, right? Like, it just doesn't really matter whose warm hands it is, like the dad's or the grandma's, or, you know, a loving nanny or, you know, daycare worker. And what you're saying is, no, mothers matter. And it's specifically mothers that matter. So I'd love for you to talk a little bit about, first, maybe this idea of mothers who get bored. Right, mothers who get bored home alone with their infants, or maybe not even alone, but just in the primary care of their infants. Is that just a personality trait? You're either like a mom who loves babies, or you're a mom who's just kind of like not a baby kind of a mom, or is there more to it?
Well, our instincts dictate that we don't attach to strangers' babies unless we are in the field. I attach to people's babies. I don't really, but I'm attracted to people's babies because I'm in the field, like nursery school teachers, therapists, infant observation people, people who are in the field, I would say, feel something for strangers' babies, right? But instinctually, a healthy mother, healthy woman, is not necessarily going to feel for other children's babies. But when she can't feel empathically or maternally preoccupied with her own baby, we say something happened to those instincts. So mammals are born with instincts that are ingrained in us, but have to be turned on, like epigenetics turns on bad genes. Instincts have to be turned on. They're there, but they have to be turned on by the environment. So what happens when you're born is that maternal care, that interest in you over everything and everyone, that sensitive empathic nurturing, that skin-to-skin contact, that love, that eye contact, that soothing tone of voice, you know, that turns on the instincts in the baby for later on, right? So when they're mothers, that gets turned on, right? So we call it generational expression. So basically, the instincts are in us to be good enough mothers, as Bettelheim said, good enough mothers, but they have to be turned on. And so the original title of my book was The Lost Instinct. And I liked that because really that's what's happened. Generations of it not being turned on means that when women have babies, they can't feel for their babies. Now, again, we say that there is underlying deep depression. You know, we think of postpartum depression as you can't get out of bed, or you want to kill your baby, or, you know, we think of it as something more psychotic. When in fact, I wrote an article for the Washington Post on how boredom with your own baby, not someone else's baby, that might be considered normal. Boredom with your own baby is a sign of deep postpartum depression. Now, what do I mean? Generational losses where that gene was not turned on. And over the generations, that instinct gets buried and buried and buried till you can barely find it at all. And that instinct is what has allowed us as a species to survive for millennia, right? That instinct is what allows other mammals to survive for millennia. And what we're doing as human beings is we are trying to erase instincts, which are, you know, you'd say the decline of a civilization happens not 0 to 60 in 3 seconds. It's like mold. It grows and is insidious and happens rather slowly, like watching the grass grow. You know, I remember an old boyfriend used to say to me, watching baseball is wonderful, but it's a little like watching the grass grow. So is raising a baby, like watching the grass grow. But so is watching the decline of a civilization, like watching the grass grow. It happens over time and it happens slowly. The dampening down of instincts one generation at a time. When a mother is disinterested in or bored with her own baby, it's a sign of deep postpartum depression and experiencing deeply unconscious losses generationally. So, do all mothers like to play with their babies? Some mothers are just characterologically more playful than others, and sort of just constitutionally more playful than others. You know, you must have playful friends and less playful friends. But and mothers were assigned the task instinctually of nurturing, which is sensitive empathic nurturing, tuning into babies' distress, making them feel safe, comforting them when they're in distress. This is a mother's role. A father's role was to play. Even in nature, you see, like, baby lions will crawl all over their, they'll crawl on their mothers, but then they'll go to their fathers and they'll really crawl and the fathers would slap them. And bears, you know, bears a little bit too, but bears are isolated with their mothers. But the idea is that there's a kind of playfulness in mammals with their fathers. Chimpanzees, you know, they'll go to their fathers and grandfathers and their fathers will swat them and they'll chase the fathers up the tree. There's more of a what we call playful tactile stimulation with fathers. So fathers are very important. Mothers play with babies in a different way than fathers do. So fathers are more into physical play. They're more into competitive play, aggressive play. Mothers don't do the aggressive, competitive, physical play as well. What they can do is sitting on the floor and doing what we as therapists call floor time, which is introducing that baby to the world and exploration. Every time a baby picks up a ball or a rattle and puts it in their mouth, that's play. That is playing with that object. That is the peekaboo game is play. And mothers do that. And what that does is it helps that child to learn about the world. First, they learn about it with their mouth and they learn about it with their movement, their body movements and getting out and crawling around. That's considered play. And again, it has to do with fascination, right? So you say you were fascinated with your work outside the home as a doctor. So being fascinated with your work is no different than being fascinated with a baby. When you look at a baby and you go, wow, 10 fingers, as we used to say, 10 fingers and 10 toes. That little person came from me and my husband. And if you believe in God or some higher, you know, that little person is a mix of cells and carbon. And it's amazing. Like, just like look at their brain grow. That fascination is instinctually applied to babies. We call it maternal preoccupation. But if it's not applied to your own baby, then we say there's some deep-seated loss where your own mother couldn't look at you and be fascinated by you, be in awe of you. And your grandmother couldn't look at your mother and be in awe of her. So again, it grows like mold on and on. And my concern, and the reason I wrote the book, is a society which marginalizes the needs of children and is blind, empathically blind and impaired to the pain of children is a society that's in decline.
So I'm calling all of my overachieving, under-receiving ladies who've been giving it their all, girl-bossing, wifing, mothering, and somehow, instead of feeling happy, content, fulfilled, and grateful, feel bitter, overwhelmed, numb, and resentful. So I'd love to give you some of my hot takes and quick tips to end this overwhelm, to shift your nervous system into a state of receiving, so that you can have and hold more, and so that you can handle what comes at you with more grace and ease and relaxation. Because a relaxed woman is a powerful woman. So I'd love to invite you to Exhale, my free masterclass where I will share reframes to disrupt your burnout patterns. I'll be offering my signature solution as well as a free gift. So register at kellybroganmd.com/exhale or at the link in show notes. I'll see you there, beauty.
So one of the elements of this decline, as far as I can see, and I know many women are observing the same, is the prioritization of freedom over caretaking, right? And over the
responsibility.
Yeah, the currency of care, especially in the home. And so if we see care as an obstacle to freedom, then we have devalued it, right? Like we don't appreciate its vital role in the fabric of society and all of the relationships that make up society, then it's easy to outsource it, institutionalize it, and depersonalize it, right? So obviously we have daycare springing up and subsidized daycare and this idea that children, you know, they need to be hanging out with other kids and socializing at 18 months. So, and that also benefits me because then I get to be at work for longer hours. But you talk about how these institutionalized caretaking resources have different priorities, right? And so if these are risk management oriented priorities, right, like for a company, let's say, that is a daycare company versus a mother or an individual, even in the family, then there are different outcomes from that kind of caregiving than there would be if a mother's instincts were intact and she were able to appreciate her vital role as caretaker. And I know, I wonder if there are women listening who also feel a degree of relief when you help us to remember that fathers are principally charged with that kind of play that looks like play, because, you know, accessing the caretaking, nurturing instinct, as you're suggesting, isn't that hard in a context and culture that expects that, that normalizes that. It is hard when we imagine that we can find fulfillment elsewhere and that this is like replaceable, right? Like it doesn't really matter who's delivering this. So what do you see as being some of the consequences of outsourcing this care, especially within the first 3 years? And that's what I think is such an important aspect of your research and your work, is to delimit this like primary responsibility to some extent, right? To that 3 year window, right? Like you're obviously a woman who has a career and has enjoyed the fulfillment that, you know, such a service-oriented career can offer. And you didn't prioritize that during the first 3 years of your children's lives, and somehow it worked out for you, right? Like the way it worked out for me, although I did and am unpacking the consequences of that emotionally and otherwise for myself, at least at this point. So if you're talking about these 3 years, right, and prioritizing your role as mother in these 3 years, and you're suggesting that swapping in another caretaking resource is not the same, what are your primary concerns about more institutionalized care, you know, that is usually called daycare?
So I'm going to say that institutions are not great for mothers or babies. And I'm going to define what I mean by that. You work as a physician. You worked in an institutional setting, which most doctors are forced to work. Doctors actually have it some of the worst. When I wrote my book, I interviewed a lot of different women from different backgrounds and professions. And the doctors would come up to me, you know, at various points and say, please write about the fact that we are treated the worst as mothers. We're treated in a robotic way, even though we're pediatricians and OBGYNs and people in the mental health field, psychiatrists. You know, that we care for others' bodies and minds, but we can't care for our own because they won't let us. And so institutions are not good. So when a doctor can say, screw you, institution, I'm going to work very part-time in the early years and increase it, and I'm going to have my own practice. I'm going to get together with two other three other women who are doctors. We're going to open our own thing. I'm going to choose a kind of medicine where I don't need to have a hospital affiliation. Maybe being a surgeon isn't a great field for a woman who wants children, because you have to have an institutional affiliation, you know, unless you have a surgical center. So now women are saying, let's invest in surgical centers and be entrepreneurs. And that way we don't have to report to men. We don't have to report to women who think like men. We can actually make our own thing. I can take a year off and take care of my baby and go back part-time 2 hours a day to a practice of my own making. I won't make a gazillion dollars for a few years, but as my children get older and older, I can make a little more and a little. And when I'm empty nest, I can make a lot of money and be very successful. Okay. I'm a good example. As I said, we can have it all, just not all at the same time. I had a 38-hour a week practice before I had children. When I had children, I stopped. And then as my children, got a little bit older, I went back an hour and a half a day. That was 2 45-minute sessions, sometimes up to 2 hours a day. So by the time my kids were a year old, I was working an hour and a half a day. So I had to have a babysitter. It was just enough to cover the babysitter because eventually I had three kids. So it was, my husband worked hard, you know, and so the babysitter and I, her name was Alba. She was wonderful. We together parented those kids, right? But I couldn't do it alone. There were three of them. And so, yeah, I'd go for an hour and a half a day and I'd come back and spend the rest of the day with my kids. But that kept my toe in my profession. But you would say in those years, I had a very, 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 very small profession. It was the least large and least important part of my life. As my kids got older, now they're adults, I was able to ratchet it up and write books and speak publicly and travel and for my work. But that didn't happen until I was in my 50s. So, and there are many stories like this. So if women can exchange fear for trust, if they can exchange their terrible fears that they'll become irrelevant. So we've made women feel that mothering is irrelevant work. If we can give them the courage to say mothering is the most relevant work, and then whatever you did before, or maybe you won't choose to do what you did before, maybe you'll do something completely transformatively different. Because becoming a mother changes you entirely. Lots of my patients who are hardcore corporate attorneys or, you know, people who worked in the corporate world say, I don't want to go back to that. I love the freedom. Freedom is flexibility. Freedom is control over your life. Freedom isn't going to a corporate job or working for an institution run mostly by men who tell you that, you know, to compete in their world, you have to be just like them. That's not freedom. Freedom is entrepreneurship. Freedom is control. Freedom is flexibility, right? That's freedom. But I want to talk about that idea of responsibility versus freedom, because this has become a conflict in society, in modern society. And why is that so? You know, that idea that was spread in the 60s of the me movement, right, said you can be an individual. You can be free of your responsibilities to the family and the home. And what I forgot to tell you is that it wasn't all bad. There was some pleasure in giving. That giving actually, there's lots of research, some of it out of Harvard, a lot of it out of a lot of the Ivy League schools, but the biggest research out of Harvard on how giving stimulates the parts of the brain, the pleasure centers of the brain. Mostly giving personally, caring for others, giving to others, volunteering. This all stimulates the reward centers of the brain, just like cocaine does, just like drugs do, just like alcohol. You know, it stimulates something in the brain, just like gambling and pornography and all those things that are bad for you. Giving does the same thing. When you go to volunteer, I remember my whole family volunteers at a at a homeless shelter in our temple. We're Jewish. And there's a homeless shelter. 12 men sleep in our temple every night. And all my family volunteer there. But my two sons have done the most there. Spent a lot of time. One of my sons cooked for the men every other week for 4 years. Opened the shelter, cooked for them, cleaned up after. So it's part of our DNA because we taught them that. That giving is pleasurable. That responsibility makes you feel good. Caring for others makes you feel good because it makes you feel in a way valued and valuable in a way like nothing else does. When we feel needed by other human beings, it creates, it stimulates the reward center.
Okay.
And reduces stress. So whenever we stimulate that part of the brain, the cortisol comes down, right? So we forgot to tell women that running from the home and from caregiving their children and their parents. Yes, it's also hard and it's also challenging and tiring. But that while you're also challenged in something, it's like running. I'm a runner. I go out and run. Nobody puts a gun to my head to run. I go out and run because it feels, it's hard. It's really hard, particularly on a day when I'm tired. But I go because it makes me feel good. Both while I'm doing it, it gives me a high, and afterwards, for quite some time, it gives me a high. And that's the best kind of high. So when we avoid hardship and we avoid everything that's work, we sometimes lose the benefits, right? So in trying to be free from the family, what got left behind is the pleasure in caring for others and giving and putting someone else before yourself, because there's something very relieving, something very burdensome in being self-occupied. It is very burdensome in a society that's fallen prey to terrible narcissistic disorders, and they've replaced other kinds of disorders in the mental health field. But there is a pleasure in putting aside our narcissism and our self-centeredness and allowing ourselves to get pleasure from focusing on another, right? So one of the things as therapists we do is we try to redirect our patients to care for someone or something other than themselves. Get an emotional support animal who you have to care for. Go volunteer in a homeless shelter. Go tutor for a school. Get the pleasure. Get your brain going so you remember there's the instinct that gets dampened down. It is our instinct as mammals. Not only to be self-focused, but to care about the pack, to care about the tribe, to care about the group, the pride, right? And so we have perverted the message of what freedom means and what responsibility means. We made it binary. We said all responsibility for others sucks and all freedom is great. And so now we have a whole population of young people, three generations in, not so young anymore, who bought this hook, line, and sinker that believe that individualism, narcissism, self-centeredness, me, is going to fill them up and make them feel an enduring sense of pleasure. And it doesn't endure. And it's led to loneliness and depression and isolation and detachment and inability to form connections with others. And this is where we are now.
I would suggest even, I don't know, maybe a layer to that otherwise binary focus on others, focus on self-quandary, which is, at least in my case, this is actually and has always been my priority and my value. But I took the bait of programming and I allowed myself to be colonized by, you know, these masculine values such that I told myself that my fulfillment lies in my achievement, my productivity, and my contribution. Because it's almost stickier when you're in a service-oriented field, right? You're doing something meaningful. It's not like, you know, I'm working for some hedge fund and it's hard to even tell like whether it's good for humanity, right? So I actually told myself my career is where my fulfillment lies. And that was never the case I see now. The case was always that my fulfillment lies in my primary relationships and specifically my relationships with my children. which many would argue, right, is the opportunity for intimacy that we are offered as mothers in a lifetime. Like there will be no more sacred container where the two individuals are equally invested in a beautiful connected outcome than a mother-child dyad. And you're given this opportunity to experience what intimacy actually is. And at least in my case, I was led to believe that the fulfillment of my heart and soul as a woman could be found in my measures of success and the many accolades, you know, that I've enjoyed, right? And that there's ever such a destination, right? And it took me building up a very successful business and having all these credentials and all these successes and New York Times bestseller and this and that to finally get to this place where I could wake up out of the anesthesia and recognize, no, actually, this whole time, my priority has been my relationship with my children, right? So it's not even just serving other. It's not even just serving my children, perhaps to the exclusion of my own needs. This is actually the way to meet my needs was to prioritize this role that I elected, you know, to take on, right? So it's also aligning with your own choices. You don't have to have a kid. You don't have to get married. If you get married, be a wife. If you have kids, be a mom, right? And somehow we're led to believe that those are, you know, quasi-commitments we can maintain while we pursue the promise of, you know, of careerism. And, you know, I think about like, at the end of my life, will I be reflecting on that blog that I wrote or this episode? Or, you know, will I be reflecting on, you know, some award I won, you know, as a clinician? Or will I be evaluating the depth to which I took my relationship with my own children? Right. I mean, it's obvious to most of us how relativizing things can be when we're asked to clarify, you know, our priorities.
But even legacy got redefined. So you're talking about Aristotle's idea of the deathbed question and legacy.
Yes, exactly.
And so legacy was, again, gaslighting, I think is the word we like to use, that legacy is about your professional identity or your professional success or how much money you leave behind. That is not legacy. Having your name on a building, being famous. Andy Warhol said you get 15 minutes, even if you're really a super celebrity. It's fleeting. It's not lasting. What is lasting is, you know, in Judaism, we say when someone passes, may their memory be a blessing. That's what we say. Sometimes you hear that on TV now and I say, oh, that's either a Jew or someone who's Jewish who told them to say that. Okay. But it's the concept is, will your memory be a blessing to the generations to come? Will your attachment style, which is healthy and loving and secure, will that be passed on generationally? For generations to come, will you have emotionally, mentally, and relationally happy and healthy grandchildren, great-grandchildren, great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren? That's your legacy. Your legacy is, did you pass on mentally healthy children to the next and the next and the next generation? Did you pass on loving children? Your legacy is not how much money you made or how many promotions you got or how famous you are. Trust me, that is a fleeting thing. You are only as famous as that remark you made yesterday on Twitter. Fame is not what it is cut out to be. And we have idealized it. We've idealized, again, narcissistic grandiosity. We have become a society that is at its root rotten. Really at its root rotten. And that isn't to say I'm hopeless. I'm very hopeful because, I mean, I have so many Instagram followers who write me and say, you know, this makes sense. No one says this. So then I get hopeful and I see there's a chance to turn this around, not for everyone. And I will say that some people will hear this and they'll get angry and defensive and say, she's wrong and none of this makes sense. And I feel that that is, it's not everyone will be able to hear this message, and that is realistic because you'd say defenses are protective. They protect vulnerability. And if the defenses are too strong, then the vulnerability, which is something that you need to feel for others. The only way you can care for others, be of service to others and your own, your children, is so you feel for them and you feel for their vulnerability. If your own vulnerability is so deeply buried inside of yourself, you cannot connect with the vulnerability of a child.
The emotional maturity and availability that you describe as the ultimate legacy, I mean, I certainly couldn't agree more. And I want to get a bit granular before we wrap up, because this really struck me when I was reading your book, and I have learned about these concepts through the study of emotionally immature parents, which is that we often tend to prioritize the physical well-being of our children over the emotional well-being, right? So, you know, our kids are eating organic and have their pumped breast milk, but we are unavailable for their tantrums or unavailable for the boredom that might set in when we're, you know, having a moment with them that feels otherwise emotionally intolerable to us on some level. You talk about how even going to, you know, a yoga class or something, right? The kind of like, I'll just pop in and out. And I am a huge proponent of self-care for women. So I think that this is an important nuance, because you suggest it's not only about career, right? So if we've made the case, which I hope we have, that heading back to your even part-time, and I want to talk about what you think the ideal is in a moment, but let alone full-time, let alone more than full-time, which was my case. You know, if we're not talking about career, but we're still talking about, you know, if your 2 or 3 month old baby is at home, again, in caring hands and arms while you run off to yoga class, and then you're finally going to get that haircut and, you know, it's time to treat yourself to a massage and you're gone for 6 hours, that also registers to this child in a way that I'm not sure we can debate. Right. Again, you can assess the consequences as you'd like.
It doesn't matter why you're gone. They don't care why you're gone. I mean, you know, you may have a very good reason. You know, mothers will say, but I had to go. And so you're making me feel guilty. And I'm like, I know you had to go, but that doesn't mean your child experienced it any differently. You see, I think when they get older, they do understand the subtlety and the nuance, children, of when parents are trying to feed them and keep the rent payments going when a single mother, but they don't understand that when they're a baby. When they're a baby, they don't know the difference. So this is us projecting onto children, like, well, I had to take care of myself, so I had to do it. Isn't that what society tells us? So the answer is yes, you must care for yourself. Otherwise, you'll develop something that mothers in the other parts of the world develop, something called maternal depletion syndrome. So we don't want to not sleep, not eat, not get fresh air, not exercise, not bathe, right? Not have contact with other people and isolate ourselves. We need to care for ourselves. It's about intensity and degree, because your baby doesn't distinguish if you are at work for 6 hours or if you've gone to the gym for 6 hours. It's still 6 hours to your baby. So the idea is incremental caring. How much caring do you actually need to do for yourself in a day? So it might mean you spend an hour on going to the gym. That's your time to care for yourself that day. Maybe you, the next day, instead of going to the gym, you go to a yoga class, right? But, you know, the idea that you go to a yoga class and go to a massage, and that society tells you, oh, it's okay, it's self-care. It's like, it's about perspective. I feel like people have lost perspective. So the idea is incremental amounts of time. Babies can hold their breath and wait for you, but then they have to breathe. And if they breathe and you're not in the air that they breathe, they go into a state of really a state of, it's like a traumatizing state for a baby, because you are the center of their universe. And if as a mammal, your smell isn't there, the sight of you isn't there, your touch isn't there, and they do distinguish their primary attachment figure from anybody else. So that is false, that just anybody will do. And so, yes, of course you can take care of yourself, and you must take care of yourself. And of course you can even work. But the fact that you're mindful, that babies can only hold their frustration tolerance so long before they collapse. And each baby is individual. So people will write me after your show and say, how many hours? And I'm like, look at your baby. If you read my book, it shows you the signs that your baby is, it's too much for them, that they're too stressed by it. The word is stressed. When you see a baby that's under stress, you go, oh, maybe I spent a little too much time away. Maybe next time I come back 15 minutes earlier and see if that's less stressed for the baby, right? So I think, I think that we're a very self-centered society, and there's just no doubt about it. And we did this to women, and we did this to children, and we did this to families. And we did this 70 years ago. We did this.
And what are the implications of this reality that a mother's presence is a biologically, emotionally stabilizing aspect of an infant and baby's development? What are the implications for, you know, for divorced parents, for surrogate parents, for, you know, gay men who adopt baby? Like, what are the implications of that mother, right? Because then you get yourself into all sorts of weeds in terms of stepping on many different agendas, if you dare to comment on this subject.
The research shows that adoptive mothers can produce oxytocin. They obviously are not going to breastfeed, but they can produce oxytocin when they singularly love that baby as their own. When that baby is handed to them, if they're healthy enough and they have, as I said, not too many losses in their own past, they can, it can turn on that instinct in them where they want to nurture that baby and they become the primary attachment figure. Now, there's all kinds of issues with adoption later on, which society doesn't want to talk about or confront because we don't want people to stop adopting children. It's really important that people adopt children, but that adoption comes with a particular set of issues that we don't want to talk about in society. Okay, but that's later on. So initially, if that baby is adopted at birth and that baby, yes, that baby loses the smell and the biological connection to its mother. But if that surrogate mother, who then becomes the primary attachment figure, who's sensitive, empathic, and can tune into that baby's and soothe that baby's distress, that person can become the primary attachment figure. So that's really important. Can men become mothers? Well, when a gay couple comes to me, the first thing I'll say is, which one of you is going to be the mother? And they look at me and they say, this child doesn't have a mother. You don't need to have a mother. And I'm like, no, you do need to have a mother. It may not be a woman in this case, but you need to have a mother. So which one of you is going to play that role? And I'm going to teach you how to be a mother because men don't naturally play that role. Men hormonally play a different role. So if you are going to play that role, we've got to alter the way you instinctually would respond to that baby. But you can be a mother, right? So, but let's say, as John Bowlby said, the primary attachment figure is the person who spends the majority of time throughout the day with that baby, soothing them from distress from moment to moment in the first 3 years. And I want everyone who's listening to this to think about whether they're actually the primary attachment figure.
Yeah, no, that's so powerful. And I so appreciate everything that you have brought to this conversation and the foundational research that has informed your perspective. And I wonder if we could close, Erica, with just one sentiment that you might offer a friend, a loved one, or a woman who is listening who is perhaps pregnant herself or planning a pregnancy, just so that she can orient around these instinctual priorities better.
One, that being a mother is the coolest job in the world and the most meaningful. Two, that more is more. The more you are physically and emotionally present for your child in the first 3 years, the greater the chance that child will be mentally healthy in the future. And three, be courageous. Don't be afraid to step off the path, because being a mother is not a linear path. If you had a wonderful career, don't be afraid to step off of that path, knowing that when you step back on, you'll be in a transformative state, probably not quite the same woman you were when you stepped off. And your goals might be different, but that doesn't mean you won't have goals. As my trainer says, my physical trainer says, we got goals. Women can have goals. They just can't do everything all at the same time and do it well.
Thank you.